true crime today.
This is the ongoing story of a small Idaho town and its residents, a tightly knit community that hasn't seen a murder since 2015, an environment where one thought they could feel safe and secure until a quadruple homicide stole the lives of four young souls on a mid-November evening, leaving far more questions than answers. Where will the investigation lead, and how do we get there? This is the University of Idaho Murders podcast. Four killed for what?
Welcome to the podcast. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any breaking updates and discussions on the case as we get them. It was a big day yesterday in the case. My name is Tony Bruschi, by the way. Thank you for joining us. Big day yesterday in the case as some items were unsealed, specifically the search warrants for Brian Koberger's apartment when they went in late December. The date on the issue on the warrant, the 29th of December, the date service of 12/30/2022. Interesting items. For a while, many were saying, well, there's just the knife sheath and there's just the cell phone tracking. I've said all along, there's far more that the police have and the prosecution has in their back pocket that they are not talking about yet. Why? Because when you initially issue the affidavit that was released for his arrest and the probable cause in that affidavit, you don't have to list every single damn thing that you have. You just have to list enough that makes it a probable cause. But now as discovery is going on, some of these things are being unsealed, parts of them redacted, but a big piece of information coming out yesterday. And we're going to go through that here. I want to let you know in just a few minutes, we're going to be talking with former FBI Special Agent Stuart Kaplan. We're going to be discussing this case, obviously, in greater detail and get his take on the evidence and the prosecution and the case against Mr. Koberger. But first, I just want to go through this list of the items that were seized and specifically listed in that search warrant. One Airrite type black glove, one Walmart receipt with one Dickies tag, two Marshall's receipts, dust container from Bissell Power Force Vacuum, eight possible hair strands, one Fire TV stick with cord, one possible animal hair strand, one possible hair, one possible hair, one possible hair. Each item is listed, so I'm not just repeating the same thing over and over. It literally is three counts of that. One possible hair strand, one computer tower, one collection of dark red spot collected without testing, it says. Two cuttings from an uncased pillow of reddish brown stain, large stain tested, it says. And two top and bottom of mattress cover packaged separately, both labeled C. Multiple stains, one tested. That's what it says. It does not go into any detail of the testing or the date of the testing or the one where it says without testing, but there's a lot that came through. And what we're probably going to find in this collection, it's not necessarily Koberger's DNA we're looking for in this collection. It's the victim's DNA. It's the hair. It's possibly the dog hair. It's possibly the blood stains. It's if we can connect evidence of the crime back to his house, that's some pretty damning evidence right there. So that's where that sits at this moment. The thing is, we just don't know what's going to happen between now and June 26. A lot of folks saying, well, there's not going to be much that happens. Just wait. I mean, it's amazing that already this weekend, 1 week after that hearing, that we're seeing all these things start to come out. So there will be a lot of interesting information that comes to light over the next couple of weeks, or the next couple of months, actually. With that, let's go to our guest today, Stuart Kaplan, former FBI agent. And Stuart, thank you for joining us. You had mentioned in a recent interview that you're confident that the alleged suspect is a controlling individual, and this alleged attack involved revenge. Understanding what we do of the suspect now, and of course he's innocent until proven guilty, what gives you your confidence in the case to make statements of that nature?
Well, first of all, if you see, I think even as of yesterday into today, there's been some slow leakage of some additional information. Keep in mind that that probable cause affidavit that was released at the time he was arrested is only a small percentage of the total evidence that they have collected to date. Mm-hmm. And with that being said, there has been evidence that has been obtained to show on multiple occasions he reached out to at least one of the victims. Now, whether or not it was an affirmative rejection or just, you know, ignoring the invitation, my understanding is that these were people that he targeted. He felt that he was being rejected, and I think in a twisted way, because I think that obviously he certainly is someone that has a demented mindset, that anyone who carries out the brutality of using a knife as the weapon of choice to kill someone, the anger and just the nature of the weapon is consistent with someone who is trying to revenge or avenge the dejection or rejection that he or she perceived at some point when their paths crossed.
Very understandable. I 100% agree. In fact, I tweeted out yesterday when we started to hear about we're talking about the Instagram connection, I believe. I tweeted literally motive and connection. If you play along with the delusional Koberger, Fantasyland, he had post on Insta that went unanswered, which his twisted mind took as rejection, which enraged him. And these girls represented everyone who ever rejected him.
And keep in mind, they socialized in the same community, meaning that his school was just several miles away from where these other students, where these victims not only lived, but also went to school. And so certainly their social paths would have crossed at certain points. And it is possible that it could have been innocent, idle, crossing a path where nothing was taken at the time. But now that law enforcement has had the opportunity to go back and check out these, perhaps what the victims may have perceived at the time as being random attempts of Brian Koberger to communicate with these individuals, it may have been done in a twisted way, with unfortunately these individuals unsuspecting that there was something nefarious or something more sinister that he was plotting or planning.
With individuals like this, I think almost every single woman alive could probably identify that there's been a creepy character in their life in some way, shape, or form who doesn't get it, essentially, when, and that's a simple way of putting it, of they don't get it. They don't understand that there's rejection, or that when I don't reply to your tweet, it means I'm not interested, or whatever it may be. But yet these type of people continue to persist. Before social media, it would have been at a bar. It would have been this place or that place. But there's these types out there, and many of them just go on for years getting rejected and wonder why they're being rejected, and truly comes down to their creepy ways of doing it and the vibe that they give off, that women have those red flags that go up. But what is it? Where does this essentially line cross? Where does he cross the line in his mind from being essentially rejected through most of his life in terms of his relationships or attempted relationships with women, to deciding I'm going to do something about this in his mind, or that he's going to take some sort of extreme action like this?
Well, certainly I think that when you go back and kind of peel back the layers of the onion in connection with this individual, meaning Koberger, it's interesting that there are a lot of people that have come forward that have now said, you know, during perhaps his high school days, and even during his college days, and up until, you know, him trying to get a graduate degree, that his behavior seemed peculiar, unusual, at times just not consistent with what we would perceive as normal behavior. The danger with someone like this is because his perceived intelligence, meaning being someone who was thought of as having higher intelligence, meaning someone who was successful in their academic community, meaning someone who, you know, was studying in criminology and then attempting to get a PhD, the danger for all of us is they blend in so well, and we really don't give them any second thought, because our perception of what a killer may look like is someone who is maybe walking down a dark alley, who's, you know, a very scary, physically imposing person, you know, someone that we see in a horror movie. And that's the perception that we in our mind, you know, believe that that's what the person is going to look like. But because of my background and the cases that I have been involved in, and I will tell you that I recall, and I speak about this often, I remember being back in Quantico at one time and going through a forensic examination in service class. And one of the United States attorney representatives came in and had a, at that time, and I'm aging myself, had Polaroid pictures of crime scenes. And those individuals who were responsible for the death and mutilation of these victims. And when you looked at them, they all looked like us. They looked like normal people. There was no one who looked any out of sorts, where he in it, or she in of themselves had a scary look to them, where if we would have seen them on the street, we would have given them a second thought. And so the unfortunate thing, and what I urge people to do, and especially in this day and age where social media is at the forefront, and given the fact that, you know, elementary school, high school, junior high school, college, graduate, our normal way of life is communicating through social media, is if you in any way sense that someone's behavior is somewhat abnormal, or even at times maybe being intimidating or threatening, or you just sense that it, his or her behavior is off, I tell people, please contact your local law enforcement agency. Let them take a report. You just never know. And especially in this day and age where I unfortunately will say that the world is upside down and there's a lot of bad people that walk amongst us, a lot of evil people that walk amongst us. I was just talking before your show on this apprehension of Brian Walsh, who's accused of killing his wife, Anna Walsh. And you look at him, and even though he may have a stellar past with respect to being a convicted felon and maybe being a fraudster, he doesn't measure up to what someone would think looks like a murderer. But if you look or heard the evidence that they have collected in connection with what he is accused of doing, he's a monster. And so he doesn't look like a monster. He looks like a normal person. And that's what I remind your listening audience of.
And that's an interesting point to make. And I've been following that case as well. What is interesting about it, between Brian Walsh and Brian Koberger, we seem to be on the year of murdering Brian's, is that they lack the empathy. They seem to, while we look at them and go, they seem a little abnormal here and there, but in their minds and in their actions, they never contemplate that. They seem to think they are normal, which allows them then to carry out such absurd crimes. With when we're talking about Walsh, the art fraud of literally stealing Warhols from his friend and reselling them, and then going a step further and selling fraudulent Warhols. And there was many other things with him, stealing $1 million from his father, $100,000 pilfered from the inheritance that he wasn't supposed to be getting. They're able to do these things with such ease. Is it because there is nothing in their brain saying, this isn't right, this is a bad idea?
I think when you look at, for example, this guy, Brian Walsh, again, a highly intelligent individual who just has gone about his life with such impunity. And even, you know, with respect to being convicted and being charged and being accused of basically being a fraudster, that in no way seemed to have dissuaded him from continuing his way of life. But the scary part, or the interesting part about him, is there's such a separation or such a gap between the behavior of quote unquote a fraudster, someone who just has larceny in their blood, who may, you know, tend to want to steal or defraud people. There, that you know, that's one type of person. You know, someone who has the impulsiveness or the tendency to be such a violent person, to then get to the point where they can not only kill someone, but also then take it upon themselves to dismember their loved one, their closest person, their wife, to kill them and dismember them and then discard them literally in garbage bags and throw them into a dumpster. That's a monster. That's an evil person. The problem that I have is, where were the signs going back to his behavior of being a fraudster? Mm-hmm. Were there any signs of this potential explosive, violent, evil person? Or was it such a suppressed manifestation of something that happened early on in his childhood? And it was just a matter of time until it got to the point where either this poor woman had decided that she was going to reveal him or expose him to his dastardly deeds, whatever he recently had done. Mm-hmm. And then he decided that the only way to deal with her, you know, instead of divorcing my wife, I'm going to kill her, and not only kill her, but dismember her. Yeah. I mean, that's a sicko. That's a whacked person. And so, again, it's just confusing to all of us because we live our lives in this, you know, believable, you know, feeling that a monster, an evil person looks like something, mm-hmm. and it really doesn't.
Yeah, I completely, and that's how a lot of people look at any sort of extreme behavior. A lot of times, for example, if an alcoholic, they must be sitting on the curb with a bottle and a bag. Correct. And it's like, no, it's actually your boss who's down the hall there that's leading a very productive life. It's usually where you least expect it. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about some of the signs that people would see, and what actually can be done, because that comes to mind a lot, especially with the Koberger case. It's coming to mind with Anna as well. There had to have been things, and this is in no way trying to blame a victim. It's more so trying to identify what traits are out there that others down the road here can kind of look out for, can kind of see, and maybe take a little more serious than just, oh, they have some trouble, or oh, they're acting weird, or they're antisocial. In Koberger's case, we heard a report the other day of when the father had dropped him off at college, his father went to the neighbor in the apartment saying, hey, you know, my son lives over here. We're talking about a 28-year-old man, but the father is still saying, hey, you know, doesn't have many friends, you know, maybe could you be his friend, to an adult child, or about an adult child, essentially. There obviously was something there that he knew that his son was a bit off, probably nowhere near to the extent that his son could do things like this. Is that true, that he just really wouldn't have known that his son is capable of this? Or sometimes when you're a father or a parent or a spouse to one of these people, are you too close to really even tell?
So to that point, and it's a great topic to talk about, because every investigation that I was ever involved in, and even after my bureau career and just, you know, coming on as an expert in all the active shooter or mass shooting cases, there is one common denominator. And that is that some of the closest people to these individuals had some sort of inkling, some sort of indication that this person's behavior was either rock bottom or changing, or just, you know, very fluidly, they were living a life of isolation. They didn't have friends. They didn't have close social relationships. And so when you look at a common denominator, and especially in mass shooting type of situations, where just, you know, out of nowhere, a person who we've never heard of, maybe even a person who's never been on the radar, gets up one day, you know, loads up his, you know, his AK-47 or his AR-15 and gets into the car and decides that he's going to start shooting up the place and killing people. Everybody says, from the outside looking in, this was the perfect person. But yet, as the investigation unfolds, all of a sudden you hear from the closest people, you know, either the mom or the dad or the sister or the brother or, you know, someone in the neighborhood who said that it was interesting. I noticed that the person was tending to live his life in isolation. He tended to mind his own business. He didn't really interact in normal social circles. And so that is a consistent underlying factor that I think is something that we as a society need to address and look at, because it's certainly indicative of people carrying out horrendous acts. And so when you talk about Brian Koberger, how is it possible that someone in their, you know, mid or late 20s who's going to college or going to graduate school would not, in the normal course of going to college, one of the best things about going to college, going to graduate school is the social aspect, right? Because after going to school, you get together with your friends or your girlfriends and you go to a bar or you go to a drinking hole or you play sports or you go to sports or whatever you do, you know, part of that is the is what we want to experience in our college days or in graduate days. It's not all about just classroom work. And so it's interesting when you hear about the father who's kind of knocking on neighbors' doors to almost solicit them to reach out to Brian Kohberg to see if they can enlist making friends with him. That's a red flag.
Yeah.
So that's a wrong, you know, a just a unfortunate situation. And, you know, it's something we should pay more attention to.
And that, I think, is the big question of paying more attention to. I want to address one thing before we continue there, because you said earlier, if someone sees those signs online, make a report. So it's there. And something that I think many will argue, go, why? Nothing's going to happen anyhow. But the real reality of that is then it's on record. So if he does get picked up for something or she gets picked up for something else down the road or another report comes in, then there's a record. And it's, you're not just the first person to say something, which is more likely to get brushed off or to be put aside because there's not a record. Is that correct?
100%. And let me just go one step further.
Yeah.
You know, more recently, and I would say probably in, let's just say, the last 5 years, I will take my hat off. Local and state and federal law enforcement has literally been working so much better together in sharing information, not only upwards, but also downwards. And by saying that, it is so important to contact local law enforcement. Why? Because oftentimes, if nothing is reported and the FBI is working a case on, you know, maybe, you know, someone who they're trying to identify as perhaps being a serial killer, it, you know, they'll go and tap into the local resources to see if there's any profile of any individual who has a report on him or her with respect to stalking, harassing, or attempting to kidnap or something of that sort. And so that's why I urge everybody that it is so important to document these encounters. Because whether the locals are going to work with the state or the state is going to work with the feds or vice versa, this information can be so pivotal, so probative, and so important in apprehension of identifying and apprehending a potential suspect in solving a case before it becomes a murder case. That's why I urge everybody, if you see something, and I know it sounds very cliche, you know, if you see something, say something, you know, and I guess we're all getting tired of hearing that, but there's a lot of truth to that.
What would you say to someone, though, who does want to do better at something like this, where they recognize the behavior, but maybe they don't want to say something for fear that something is said, and then maybe there's a little visit that's paid to that person that is in question, not an arrest, but enough to know that someone tipped them off, that there's something a little bit off. And then they have to fear for their own safety because that person's not going to get arrested unless a crime has been committed. And then everybody's just kind of still out there in the ether of whatever the hell that, whatever that person is capable of doing to do.
To that point, and again, boy, talk about, you know, touching on great topics and great relevant topics. Unfortunately, this past Monday in Fort Pierce, Florida, there was a mass shooting. There were 8 people that were shot. And unfortunately, one person, a beautiful young lady with a child, she succumbed to her gunshot and she was killed. And part of the problem in Fort Pierce is the community is less than willing and probably unwilling to cooperate with law enforcement in trying to identify and apprehend the individual or the individuals that are responsible for carrying out this shooting on a day which should have been the most important day. I mean, my God, Martin Luther King Day, you know, what a day to celebrate, right? You know, and to have all of a collection of people celebrating at this school or at this park, and then you have, you know, this type of incident unfold. You know, law enforcement's frustration is that, you know, this community does not want to come forward and identify the individual or the individuals. With that being said, though, the sheriff came on TV last night and urged the general public that there are numbers that are set up through Crime Stopper where you can maintain your anonymity, meaning you can give an anonymous tip and it will be taken as if you walk into the police station and identify yourself. And the FBI and state and local law enforcement now, and again, because of our capabilities in the social media world, you can send tips in through Instagram. You can send tips in through Facebook. You can tweet your tips. I mean, you can, you know, send an email. You can call a tip line and you can maintain to be anonymous. And so what I would say to your point is, listen, back in the heyday when a cop or a detective would want you to come into the police station and sit you down and, you know, get your name and your date of birth, your social security number, and you were all concerned about, well, wait a minute, if the bad guy is apprehended, he's going to know it was me who turned him in. We don't live in that world anymore. We live in a world where law enforcement completely appreciates and understands what it is or why it is that people may not want to cooperate unless they are assured that their identity will be protected. Again, I understand that some people may say, even though a police officer says that even if I talk to them, they promise me that my identity will be protected. What I say to people is then pick up the 1-800 number and call and leave an anonymous tip. That anonymous tip will be treated exactly the same as if you walked into the police station. And hopefully that tip will lead to the apprehension and, more important, the apprehension and solving of, for example, in Fort Pierce, you have 8 people that were shot and 1 person who's dead. And this is a perfect example of why those people should come forward, pick up the phone. I understand why they would be scared and why they would be intimidated, but there are avenues that are available to them to maintain their identity and protect their identity.
Aren't we really talking about kind of 2 different type scenarios, though, with that? One where it's a massive amount of people, it's a big group setting. You could easily do anonymity or maintain anonymity by reporting something because there's just so many damn people. But with something like a wife, like Anna, Anna Walsh, or maybe a parent of Brian Koberger, these people fairly secluded to a certain extent. And no matter if something was turned over, if some sort of stone was turned over and shown to the police of, I think this person could be dangerous, but they have yet not committed a crime. They're acting a bit strange.
Let me interrupt you. And as you are familiar, in more recent years, we have what's called the red flag laws.
Okay.
And that has been so instrumental in neutralizing and incapacitating those individuals, thankfully, mm-hmm. where loved ones have taken the initiative to come forward and say, look, my husband, my brother, my niece, my nephew, you know, their behavior is off. And also, I believe that they may be in possession or have access to a weapon. Mm-hmm. Well, those red flag laws, and by the way, that's a civil process. They're still due process. It's not just we go in and take your guns and, you know, you're deprived of your Second Amendment and you're not going to have your day in court. Absolutely to the contrary. But again, this was a way to remedy
Sure.
what you're talking about.
I think a lot of times people, especially a spouse or a parent, they're not wanting to get someone in trouble per se. They're more so wanting to get someone help. For these things, and whether or not help is even something that can be done for some of these mindsets is a whole other conversation. But when you are in that sort of situation, let's say you're Koberger's dad, you know your son's kind of odd. You don't really know exactly what he's capable of doing, but he has this fascination. If you just look at the signs that are out there, or others may have pointed out that there's potential there. Is there anything one can truly do in that sort of thing? Could Koberger have been prevented? We don't really know at this point in time if there's any evidence of him planning anything on paper or any sort of evidence that would come out that we could say, hey, look, we caught this before he did it. If this is all in his mind and he's just planning this over and over, is there anything that can be done to stop this other than earlier mental health detection and help?
You know, there's no way to legally cause or require a parent to turn in their child, mm-hmm. right? And the closest we saw play out, and again, a terrible case, Gabby Petito, right? Yep. And so there's a poor girl who was on a road trip across the country, and we all know what happened to her and how that played out. And then there was a lot of comment and a lot of criticism and a lot of concern as to whether or not the person who was responsible for her death, whether or not his parents assisted, whether or not they aided after the fact to cover it up. That's the only time, really, either as an accessory before the fact or an accessory after the fact, that you can legally potentially hold someone responsible for either not doing something or for doing something in furtherance of assisting someone who may have committed a crime. And so, to your point, look, if a parent or a loved one knows that their child is just out of his mind or out of her mind, there's no obligation, no legal obligation that would create some legal liability that a parent must come forward and get that child help. But I would say to any human being, any person who's living in this world that we are living in today, that wouldn't you rather try to save not only your child, but that loved one, but also prevent perhaps that same person at some point engaging in some impulsive behavior where he or she gets up on one particular day and, you know, grabs their weapon and goes out and decides to shoot up the place. And now you have to live with the guilt of knowing that there were some signs that you should have done something to prevent your child from going out, because you knew it wasn't if, it was just a matter of when they were going to do that. And so I would hate to live with that. And so I would just say, I guess maybe it's more of a morality question as being a fellow human being to do what is right, not only for yourself and your child, but to do what is right for us living together in this world.
Stuart Kaplan, former FBI agent, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your insights on this case. We do greatly appreciate it. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any breaking updates and discussions on this case. You can get a commercial-free experience on Apple Podcasts. You can try that for 3 days free right now. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod. My name is Tony Bruschi. For all of us here at True Crime Today and the University of Idaho Murders Podcast, thank you for listening.